This is Bayard Winthrop, founder of American Giant. I started this company because I was fed up with cheap clothes that didn't last and companies that shipped manufacturing overseas. We believed we could still make incredible clothing right here in the US with American cotton and American workers earning real wages. That's what we stand for, making clothes that actually last. Get 20% off your first order when you use code GIANT20 at American-Giant.com.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports Podcast. I'm Dave Zirin. We have a hell of a show for you this week. We're going to talk later to Frankie De La Creta about the Winter Olympics and their incredible view of what went down. But first and foremost, I'm really thrilled to be talking about the legacy of Reverend Jesse Jackson through the lens of sports. And I can't think of anyone better to talk to about this than Bijan C. Bain. Let me tell you a little bit about who Bijan Bain is. He is an author and screenwriter whose work explores these connections, which we try to explore in our podcast, between sports, media, race, and power. So he's right in the edge of sports wheelhouse. He focuses on moments where athletes stop being entertainment and become cultural inflection points. Bijan has written more than I could possibly list for you, so I want to actually highlight his upcoming nonfiction book, which is called 1967, The Year That Changed Everything, and I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that he's going to be executive producing and is the lead writer upon the upcoming docuseries Game Changers of the Century. It's an honor to have him on. Bijan Bain, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing good, brother. Good to see you again. Nice to speak to you on this somber but celebratory occasion in two different ways.
Exactly. I mean, well put, because anytime you lose a giant like Reverend Jesse Jackson or us locally here, Reverend Graylin Hagler, who passed the same day, you know, there's this balance you have to strike because they leave a hole that just feels like a chasm, just unfillable. But at the same time, the life must be celebrated in the spirit of we owe it to their memory to try to fill that gap that's been created by their passing.
Yeah, and also just celebrate the fact that they were, which is, you know, we're all human, and even Bob Gibson, who I couldn't even imagine dying. I can only imagine, like, the Grim Reaper walks out to the mound to take the ball, and he's like, if you don't get back in the dugout, I'm gonna bean you. But even those kind of people, Jim Brown, you know, Muhammad Ali, succumbed to that. But we celebrate the fact that they were with us and that they gave up so much for the rest of us.
Mm. Bob Gibson, Dr. Martin Luther King's favorite baseball player. Just, I'd be remiss to not point that out. A little factoid I found doing some research, and I was like, whoa.
Interesting.
Because it is interesting for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, you wouldn't think, yeah, very aggressive pitch. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
But I can see Dr. King sort of vicariously living through Gibson's aggressiveness because he was not allowed. Yeah, I could see that a little bit.
You can see it. Yeah, it sort of spells itself out in its way. The fearlessness, the aggression, and the if you mess with me, I'm not going to turn the other cheek. I'm sure it was at least vicariously satisfying for somebody who was often straitjacketed politically, even though he broke through that straitjacket on more than one occasion, of course.
Sure, sure.
So let's talk Jesse Jackson in sports, the Reverend Jesse Jackson. You know, I don't know much, Bijan, which is why I wanted to have you on the show. What I think about is this amazing photo of him playing hoops with Marvin Gaye, with them both wearing those 1970s short shorts. And it's hard not to notice that Reverend Jackson is built like an athlete in the early 70s playing this game. But so what can you tell us about Reverend Jackson in sports? Where did his love of sports come from? And what did he see sports as? Like its social purpose? How did he see it relative to the movement?
Okay, well, let's unpack those two things. Anyone who's ever been in an event where Jesse Jackson was speaking or in a hotel lobby or airport where they experienced his presence, the first thing that strikes you is his imposing physical presence. And the first thing you notice is this guy looks bigger than I might have thought before I experienced him in person. He looks like a football player. Well, that's because he was. So he first experienced sports as a very accomplished athlete himself. So that defines the rest of his life in terms of his bravado, his competitiveness, his confidence, and the way he moves in spaces, and the way he feels around other athletes, comfortable around the Jim Browns and the Muhammad Alis, who are about the same height he was and about the same breadth that he was. And he was a very good high school pitcher in Greenville, South Carolina, scouted and offered a bonus by the White Sox, and an elite high school quarterback in that segregated system who was offered and accepted a full athletic ride to the University of Illinois, although he only played 2 semesters. So he was that tier of athlete decades before he meets Jordan, before he meets Mike Tyson, 10 or 15 years before he meets Muhammad Ali. He's like a schoolboy two sports star in a Jim Crow system.
Wait, so I have to, and you'll excuse me if I do, I have to interrupt on occasion just to get a sense of things. So you're saying, I want my listeners to know how big a deal with this is. You're saying he was recruited to play quarterback at the University of Illinois at a time when to be a black quarterback was to be a news story unto itself. It was so rare if you were not at an HBCU.
Yes, that's actually true, although it's unclear even in his memoirs and things of that nature whether they wanted to move him to a skill position or something like that, because he didn't stay after 2 semesters. Some accounts say he didn't stay because of near the campus, he participated in like a, I don't know if you want to call it a sit-in, because Greensboro was just kind of he participated in a protest to integrate a library, probably his second semester, maybe. And of course, freshmen couldn't play varsity college football in the early 60s, as you know. But, and some accounts say once he figured out that they weren't going to let him be the signal caller, that's when he decided to transfer to North Carolina A&T. But by either account, he was a two-sport star who was recruited by a Major League Baseball team, offered a bonus, and turned it down because he opted for college football.
Wow, that's incredible. And I believe one of his sons played college football as well, right? Yusef Jackson.
A couple of them actually did, Nick.
Oh.
DC kids. Yusuf played for UVA. He was a linebacker. And Jesse played for North Carolina A&T. He's a halfback. And they both went to St. Albans right in town.
Wow. And St. Albans, which has produced tremendous pro athletes and Hall of Famers in
Yep,
its time.
Jonathan Ogden. Yeah.
Jonathan Ogden himself, the Ogden brothers playing there were just terrifying. But we could have a whole side discussion about Jonathan Ogden, fascinating figure for the Baltimore Ravens. So Jesse Jackson, he's becomes at a very young age a central player in the civil rights movement, marching next to Dr. King, put in charge, I believe, of Operation Breadbasket. If that's correct, and
Yeah.
at a very young age, how did he see sports as being integrated into the civil rights work that, of course, consumed his professional life for the next 6 decades?
From what I can tell, he took his natural leadership ability and his the confidence and swagger that that gave him, because when he transferred, he went to North Carolina A&T and he quarterbacked there. So that demands a lot of memorization, play calling, teammates trusting in you, body carriage, being able to absorb punishment and things of that nature. It's leadership. And pitching is kind of leadership too, even though it's a much different sport in the way that the offenses and the defenses interact, but you kind of have the ball. And I think that sort of transferable presence that he had suited him well, because he became student body president at A&T, and he was a grand basileus, which is a pretty high rank in Omega Psi Phi, when he was about 24. So he's just like a, it's almost like a born or at least bred leader. So when he's in SNCC and when he's a student, even at the University of Illinois, he's already participating in protests. And then he transfers to A&T, where the sit-in, as we know it, was born. The
Wow.
Greensboro lunch. So he's literally on campus, like maybe 61 or early 62, with the same people that participated in the Woolworth sit-in. So the time and his manner and his natural gifts sort of melded or meshed from what I can tell to make him sort of a wunderkind of people that the Kings and the Abernathys and the Shuttleworths, who are clearly older than he, could count on because they knew that he was up to the task because he just had a leadership bent.
That's powerful in and of itself. Is there, so he plays quarterback, he becomes a youth leader in the civil rights movement, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's going to understand the value of sport to project the ideas of the civil rights movement. Is there a moment that we know about, or an athlete that we know about, who gave him a little bit of a eureka moment? Of saying, I'm not going to put sports, my own sports history on the shelf in order to leave this movement, but I'm going to try to integrate it into the movement.
Well, often he's quoted as saying he's only 6 months older than Muhammad Ali. I think, you know, he's born like October 41, and Ali, as you well know, January 17, 42. So I think the time period that they both grew up in, where they would have been like 14 when Emmett Till was killed, when he was an early activist in the movement, he would have been like 23 when Ali and when Cassius Clay announced that he was Cassius X. And although Jesse was not philosophically aligned with that movement, there's two things. One, by the mid-60s, he is in Chicago, where that movement is headquartered. And two, on April 4th, 1967, as you know, Dr. King made his first public statement or public presentation being vocally against the U.S. involvement in Vietnam, the Riverside Church speech. Well, right before that speech, King and the Reverend Andrew Young and Jesse Jackson and maybe a couple other aides are in King's hotel room in New York City, and they're just kind of going over things and, you know, last few hours before that kind of thing that people do in hotel rooms. And there's a knock on the door, and you know, Jesse's one of the probably the youngest person in the room, of course. There's a knock on the door, and it's Muhammad Ali and Jim Brown. So this is like 3 weeks before Ali fights Zora Foley in New York. So it's right before his last fight before the forced exile. But it's already kind of known that he might have his title stripped. So Jim Brown and Ali come into the room. I'm not sure if it's after the Cleveland summit or before, probably after. Because Houston's about to happen in August, the induction day. But whatever the case, that's the Ali that he met, probably already knew, but that's the Ali that he met with Jim Brown that day. And I think just the gravity of having those people in a room, which could be its own feature film, again, even though Jesse Jackson was, of course, not a black nationalist or a separatist, he, as a fellow athlete and as a fellow 6'3 man who was not physically intimidated by Jimmy Brown or Muhammad Ali, would have been, you know, the kid in that room, but also respected and a person who would have been tutored by the Kings and the Abernathys and the Shuttlesworths that were older than he. So he was kind of well prepared for those kind of moments. And who knows what kind of impact it had on him when Ali did, you know, make that stand. Instead, it was like not somebody that he watched on TV, it was a man that he knew. So that had to have played a role. And then just being in that whole ecosystem of like Cleveland Summit and things like that. Of course, Alcindor was even younger than Jesse was. But I mean, just the times and the proposed athletic boycott of Mexico City games. I mean, Jesse's like 25 and 26 when this stuff is happening, and he's an athlete. So he can kind of relate to these guys on two fronts, activist and probably a lot more publicly vocal than they are, but also competitive and not that far from his own playing days, where he can relate to them as a human being and as a well-rounded person and as a man who has to train and compete and practice. So he wasn't walking into those rooms as an outsider.
That's a huge part of it, I think. You know, one of the things about Jesse Jackson, I mentioned at the top, I knew very little about his sports history, but I do know that when I wrote the book, the John Carlos story, alongside the great Dr. John Carlos, we went to Chicago for our book tour, and Jesse Jackson, the Reverend, he welcomed us with open arms at Operation Push headquarters. He put on a meeting for us. Dr. John Carlos spoke to a packed house alongside Reverend Jackson. What does that tell us? So talk to us a little bit, please. Like what do you, from everything you know, 1968, the raising of the fist, John Carlos, Tommy Smith, Peter Norman in solidarity. What do you think that meant to Jesse Jackson, particularly the fact that it occurred only a few months after the assassination of Dr. King?
You know, it's hard to say because we silo these things in retrospect as one person was an integrationist and one person was a black nationalist. This person was a Panther. This person was anti-war. This person was a hippie. This person was. But when all these things were happening in real time, I think there was a sense of respectful solidarity, even if I don't philosophically agree with you on everything that you do. In other words, King felt more courageous about making his Riverside Church speech because of what Ali had already said in public. King
Yes.
said that. It's not to say that King's going to join the Nation of Islam. That's not how things work. So I think we think of these things, 50 years after the fact, 60 years after the fact, differently than they were experienced in real time. And so when he saw the Black Power salute, because he was sort of their generation and because he had been around militants and people with a more militant, quote unquote, than he knew Stokely, he knew Rap Brown. I'm sure that he had to have a level of respect because he knew about the proposed boycott, which means they wouldn't have even been in Mexico City. He knew that was happening. And some people still didn't go, like Kareem. And he's an athlete. So he realizes the sacrifice that they're making. These guys are going to be banned from the Olympics for life, and they're not going to be able to make any ancillary income from their medals. So I think he's looking at it two ways, like a highly competitive former athlete himself. And I think the White Sox bonus speaks to the fact that he just wasn't some middling, oh, he was an HBCU, anybody can play quarterback there. No, you're playing quarterback there when NC State and UNC couldn't recruit black players, and Wake Forest couldn't recruit black players. So that means you're one of the best players in North Carolina and South Carolina. And Illinois recruited him. So he had to have been good. I think he must have felt like, these guys are courageous, just as courageous as I was when I was walking with Dr. King in that open housing march in Gage Park, and they were throwing stones and bricks at us. Different stance, but courageous nonetheless. I think that he felt Ali's resistance was courageous. I don't think people felt like, oh, your leader hates white people, so everything you do is therefore non grata and off the books because of, no, people weren't, we weren't as polarized then, especially in the freedom movement. I think the freedom movement respected other positions and didn't have this sort of siloed or monolithic viewpoint of how to get to the other side and how to get to a more equal society.
Yeah,
And
one black freedom struggle.
that's just the sense of it I get. And I think they felt that the two extremes of it, and he wasn't on either end of the extreme because Breadbasket and Push are about other things like businesses and things like that nature. It's closer to Jim Brown. But I think the two extremes of it did feel like they forced society to reckon with either one or the other, or something in between. I
You
mean, the
know,
Panther, yeah, I mean, you know what I mean?
yeah, very much, very much. You know, one part of his legacy in sports that I do know about Reverend Jackson is he gave the eulogies for people like Jackie Robinson, Joe Louis, Joe Frazier. I think Curt Flood, although I'm not sure, but like these giants in that history of sports and social justice, when they transitioned, he was there to speak over their memories. Can you? I'm not quite sure what the question I have about that is, but what does that tell us? That for the families of these great figures, they wanted Reverend Jackson to be the person to really sum up their lives and give people a sense of their history.
I think that's one of his most important legacies, and I think it's enormous because he's a generation younger than Jackie Robinson. He was only a little kid when Jackie broke in, maybe six. And I think the fact that he's this bridge between, you know, Shuttlesworth and C.T. Vivian and Wyatt T. Walker and King and us. So by King being killed, he becomes the next man up. I mean, Abernathy is the next man up structurally and generationally, but he's not a dynamic public speaker in an electrifying order. So, and he's obviously Dr. King's best friend. But Jesse Jackson is younger, has more of a sway with the 18 to 25s. He's, as you stated, founded his own organizations in Chicago, or at least headed them. And he is dynamic on the podium. So that gift makes him the logical choice if you're a Rachel Robinson, if you're the Joe Louis family, no matter, regardless of the fact that he was young. I mean, he's only still like 31 when Jackie died. But by then, he's like the most prominent civil rights leader in the country at 31. It's kind of like Bill Clinton being governor at. It's just one of those things where if you exhibit leadership early enough, you put yourself in the right rooms and they respect you, the torch gets handed to like, well, this is the thing. The civil rights movement after those first sit-ins is sort of an undergrad thing. It's Diane Nash, it's Bevel, it's, you know, Courtland Cox, it's Stokely as an undergrad at Howard, it's Angela, it's a kid, yeah, it's bottom up.
Wow. So, Bajan, you've been so generous with your time. I really appreciate it. Is there anything else you want listeners to know about this history of Reverend Jackson and the sports world?
I don't think he ever stopped thinking of himself as being an athlete or
I
as a
agree.
CIAA athlete or an HBCU athlete. And the evidence of that is, I mean, and we got to give him credit for other things that he did that just show how close he was to athletes. Like he would sit alongside Jordan down at bench level during like charity games and all-star games and things like that because Jordan was Chicago-based. He baptized Mike Tyson. He's close, you know, relatively close to teenage LeBron. But this thing about never really thinking of himself as a non-competitor and having these sons that competed, which kept him in the game even longer. He was at a political rally in Wilmington, Delaware in the early 2000s, and there was a city council chair in Wilmington in those days named Ted Blunt. And Ted Blunt had played basketball for Big House Gaines down at Winston-Salem State around the same time that Jesse was quarterbacking at A&T, like, you know, 63 to 65-ish. So at the rally, Jesse Jackson spots Ted Blunt in the crowd and shouts in full HBCU CIAA sort of volume, "Ready, Teddy Blunt!" Which shows you, like, you know, these
Wow.
guys like Al Attles and Earl Monroe and Ted Blunt. I saw these guys play in college because they played my school, and I still see them for the athletes that they were, even though they've moved on to become city council persons or things of that nature. I don't think he ever forgot that that young Jesse, that camaraderie, that rivalry that was forged in those segregated conferences.
Amazing. And as we're talking, I'm also remembering, I write about sports and politics. I was remembering that like the first column I ever wrote that tried to mix those worlds was because Reverend Jackson led a protest at the University of, where was it? I believe it was the University of Alabama, because they were going to hire Mike Shula as the football coach instead of Sylvester Croom. And if they'd hired Sylvester Croom, who played under Bear Bryant, he would have been the first black head coach in the history of the Southeastern Conference. And I believe not even just for football, but for any sport. And this
Probably at
is,
the time, yeah, because Tubby
yeah.
wasn't there.
And this was 2005. I mean, it's or 2004. I mean, it's that part as well. It's just so incredible to me that he brought this political perspective into sports, and that had certainly a strong ripple effect on me, because it was just like I had those issues siloed in my brain: sports, black freedom, the movement. And then here he is bringing those together, not in the historical sense, which I knew about, Ali, you mentioned Jim Brown, Smith and Carlos, but bringing it into the sense of present day activism. And that was something I think he also was never shy to do, to look for civil rights opportunities in the world of sports in the present tense, to be able to shake things up in that world.
Yeah, he stayed very modern and contemporary. I mean, he
Yes.
was always at something where you were like, you'd be watching it with sort of like casual people that don't follow history that closely, or obviously lived in DC for decades, and people would say, oh, he's still around, like, the Obama run and things like that. But even like 86, 85, he went on record as saying the biggest threat to the young black community was drugs. In 86, when Lyn Bias died right outside of DC, he and Congressman Charlie Rangel, who might have been the chair of the Black Caucus at that point, lobbied President Reagan to start a war on drugs. So it's
Interesting.
not just sport. Yeah, he saw sport. He did all these things that touched sports. Like there was a case in 2007 at a football game in some part of Illinois where six kids, not players, six kids in the stands got into a brawl, and they were suspended from school for 2 years. And Jesse Jackson interceded with the school administration or school board and said 2 years is just really too harsh for like a brawl at a high school football game. But I think, as a football player himself and his sons played high school football, I think he's this well-rounded person who doesn't come to sports the way a lot of us do. He comes to it as an insider looking in
Yeah.
with a respect for, like, no, I'm not saying that getting into a fight, I'm not rationalizing what they did because my sons played high school ball. Well, what I'm saying is 2 years? Really? I mean, by the time the suspensions are lifted, they're high school, and just the stain that it would leave on a person's life at that point. But I think he always tried to help athletes see the complexities, the ways in which they might be being manipulated, whether the sneaker companies were giving back. And I think they might have trusted him because he was the same size they were.
That can't be undervalued, I think, that he carried himself like an athlete. And if people don't understand what that means exactly, it's one of those things where if you know, you know.
Yep, and if you're in a room where you're not that person and everybody else is Wes Unseld or Kareem or Jim Brown, you feel, even though on paper you're not those people, but when you're in their presence, you're like, I see why this person could run through linebackers.
Yeah.
Even though they can't do it anymore. Or John Carlos, even in his 70s, you're like around him and you're like, guy looks like he could still maybe dust off a couple people if he wanted to.
Yeah, run the 100 in under 10 flat if he really set his mind to it.
Their mindset too, their presence. That confidence never leaves that person, even if they're channeling it into other things, as you well know by being around Dr. Carlos.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, let me tell you something, Bijan Bain, this was such an eye-opener to speak to you. I want to say to my audience, first of all, look up Bijan Bain's books. I mean, they're just incredibly, I will say, unique and original at this intersection of sports and politics. When a lot of people, frankly, I see a lot of these books, then they're kind of carbon copies of one another. And I feel like what you've brought to the table over your career has been utterly original. And really appreciate you and really appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, coming from a person who pretty much is the most respected presence in that lane, that means a lot.
Please, right back at you. And if anybody out there has not seen the photo of Reverend Jackson playing one-on-one with Marvin Gaye, well, then you're just missing out on what perhaps might be the coolest photo in the history of photography. So do check that out if you get the chance.
Yeah, it kind of does define the 70s.
Oh my goodness, does it ever, man? Does it ever? Yo, for everybody out there listening, we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with Frankie Della Creta to do a wind up and a roundup. Believe me, it'll be both of the 2026 Winter Games. We'll be back right after this with a quick word from Edge of Sports. Hey, everybody out there, this is Dave Zirin with the Edge of Sports podcast. People got to know that we put this podcast on with elbow grease and bubble gum on a weekly basis. And we're proud of the work that we do. We love it, but we can't do it without support from you, the listener. So please go to patreon.com/edgeofsportspod and support the podcast. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. Any little bit you might give to support the podcast actually makes a huge difference to the work we're trying to do. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. We appreciate you. Make no mistake about it. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. We are back on the Edge of Sports podcast. Our next guest is a return guest, so they need no introduction. They are an independent journalist whose work focuses on the intersection of sports, gender, and culture. They are the co-author of a tremendous book called Hail Mary: The Rise and Fall of the National Women's Football League. And they write the queer sports newsletter Out of Your League that for me has been indispensable during these 2026 Olympic Games. And that's why I have them on the show. Their name is Frankie Della Creta. How you doing, Frankie?
I'm doing well, Dave.
It's so great to be here. So first, right before we rung in to talk to each other, there was news that the U.S. women's hockey team has formally and publicly refused an invitation from Donald Trump to go to the White House after he mocked them to the men's team as they were celebrating, and the men's team all laughed and had a big chuckle with Kash Patel and the president. It shows some serious backbone that they said, no, I wanted to get your response about why it was important for them to draw that line.
Okay, I have two. One, I have a cynical reaction, and then I have like a best, assuming best faith reaction.
Love it.
I will say, assuming the best faith here, I think it is a very big deal that they have refused the invitation. I think hockey, among all of the like kind of big five sports, hockey is the most conservative politically. And especially because the US team has at least one player on it who has been very anti-trans and very kind of aligned with, MAGA-ish views. I appreciate this. I think it might be taken as a political statement that I don't know if they intended to make. And so that's my like cynical reaction is because the PWHL season starts, like we're in the middle of it, I think the reasoning for them declining around schedule and timing makes a lot of sense. I think it's an easy out. I think it was probably a way of doing it while kind of keeping their hands clean. So it kind of seems like they're not picking a side, even though I guess we can choose to think maybe they're picking a side by declining it, but the way they declined actually keeps them pretty politically neutral.
That's a great point. It was just, I guess for me, I'm assuming more towards the best just because it felt really bang, bang, like all this publicity about how disgusting Trump's comments were. And then, you know, just in the almost immediate aftermath of that, just like, oh, you don't want us to go? You feel like we have to go? You feel like you'll be impeached if we don't go? Well, screw you, we're not going. I mean, they could always do what some NFL teams done and send a representative or two. It felt, I guess, more substantive than that, but I also admit I'm the kind of person who's always searching for nuggets, and I call them gold when they might just be brass.
I mean, you know, they went in 2018 to the White House, aside from a couple of players. So there is precedent here where they've accepted invitations in the past. At the time, they weren't in the middle of a professional season because the PWHL did not exist. You know, so there is that. My guess is if it is a somewhat political reason for declining, it would be much more because of the insults to them as a team and to women's sports as a whole, and much less because of like what Trump's politics are, if that makes sense.
Oh, agree with that 100%. So Howard, let's now get why I really wanted to talk to you. Like, big picture, how are you going to remember these 2026 Winter Games?
You know, you actually know this about me because we met before I was a sports writer, because I was organizing against the Boston 2024 Olympic bid. And, you know, so for people who don't know, you actually flew up to Boston on your own dime to speak at an event that we were organizing, which I was really appreciated. But knowing that about me, you kind of probably know how I feel politically about the Olympics. And so I find myself really conflicted watching them most of the time. And I wasn't not conflicted this time, but I will say I enjoyed these Olympics more than I have other Olympic games in the past. And I think there was something for me about athletes in general and women's athletes, but the U.S. women this year, I don't know. There was something really joyful about a lot of the athletes this year in ways that I really appreciated. And I think leading up to these games, there was so much negative press and worry about whether, you know, ice was going to be there and, you know, the kind of immigration crackdown we're having in this country, that there was so much, I think, yeah, just negative and kind of buzzkill press going into the games, that I think I was surprised how much I enjoyed them.
Well, there was a lot of heart and a lot of spirit. And you know my position, like, I love these sports a la carte. I just hate, you know, the detritus that they drag along with them into these host cities.
But yes.
And the way some of these athletes use their platform to be repulsive, like the U.S. men's hockey team. So yeah. I loved your newsletter so much during these games. Everybody should sign up for it, because you really were able to also draw out that this was as LGBTQIA and Olympics in memory. And it was beautiful, but you had to look for it, of course. Peacock wasn't going to show it to you. Could you speak to that, if you don't mind?
Yeah, I think, you know, there was somewhere around, I think 49 was the official count of openly queer athletes. And at a Winter Olympic Games, that's a lot of athletes, actually. Mm-hmm. It's the most out Olympics or out Olympians there have ever been at an Olympic Games. You had Hillary Knight, the captain of the U.S. women's hockey team, get engaged to her speed skater girlfriend, Brittany Bowe. And that was, you know, televised. They did packages about that. Mm. The women's hockey final was also like the gayest hockey game in Olympic history. There was like 9 out players between the two teams. And so there were a lot of openly queer players and athletes. And I mean, I generally think sports are pretty gay. You had Amber Glenn too, who is the first openly queer woman in Olympic figure skating history, which is like a massive deal. And she wears a pride pin on her jacket. And I think it's really important because in this day and age, we think of how much progress has been made for LGBTQ people in general, but we're in a period of kind of conservative pullback. We're seeing anti-gay laws passed. We're seeing, at the games, Grindr, which for people who don't know, which I'm sure most people do, but it's a gay hookup app that's location-based. They had to turn off their location services, which is how the app operates, to keep Olympians in the, Olympic Village safe, and to avoid them being, outed against their will. And so to be openly queer at the Olympics, in this day and age is maybe easier than in times past, but it's still a really big risk and it's still an act of resistance. And so it was everywhere if you looked for it.
I'm so glad you caught that contradiction, because this should be something at this point, after Olympic cycle of queer athletes, that you certainly have done a tremendous job highlighting, other forces in media have as well. But this year, even with the record number, it did feel daring. And in a way, that's sad, because it's about the larger political climate, but it also makes you realize how much it matters as well. And I was inspired by it. Every time I got your newsletter, I was like, okay, something to feel like I'm on more solid foundation about.
Absolutely. And I think people don't realize, even in the host country of Italy, right? Gay marriage isn't legal there. And gay couples can't adopt because only married couples can adopt. And there are these surrogacy laws that, prevent couples from going over, like crossing borders, going overseas for surrogacy, which again disproportionately impacts queer people. There was a massive spike in anti-LGBTQ violence in Italy last year because of the far right, politicians that are coming to power there. And so we're talking, globally, we're seeing this kind of fascism creep. And it impacts, there was at least a skeleton racer, a Belgian skeleton racer who is married to a Brazilian skeleton racer. And the wives both competed, and they were inspired to actually be more public with their relationship and to speak up because of the fact that they were coming to Italy and because of the political climate for, queer folks in that host country.
Wow. Yeah, very well put indeed. I certainly think most people who were imbibing in the Olympics had no idea about Italy and its recent history and why all that ma makes it matter all the more, like in Sochi when they were out athletes. Like, it actually has a real, probably national impact in the country that we don't even realize.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So I want you to highlight one name that I pulled from your newsletter because I found it particularly interesting. Connor McDermott Mostowy, if I've pronounced the name right. Could you tell us a little bit about Connor McDermott Mostowy?
Yeah, he is a speed skater for Team USA, and he's the first openly gay male speed skater that the US has had. And he was fantastic. I discovered his social media account, and he was kind of like the MVP of social media for me at the games. I found his content really, really enjoyable, because, him and his boyfriend were just sort of gallivanting around the lawn making content together. And he's just very himself in a way that, so many elite athletes are really restrained and they're really intense. And, that's okay. There's certain personality traits that come with being an athlete at the level that these people are. And he was, very much not that. He doesn't have pre-competition rituals, which I actually have never heard of an athlete not having those before. But yeah, I just really appreciated him because, as we are talking about, like, so many sports are very like toxically masculine, and like of the skating sports, it's figure skating, right, that has many more openly queer men, and there's allowed to be a lot more like effeminate presentations. And to see somebody competing in one of the more traditionally masculine sports and still like very much being himself in that way, I really enjoyed, and it felt like radical and subversive.
No doubt about it. There was that Other notable moment. Oh, first of all, before I move on to another political topic, is there anything else you want to say about this queering of the Olympics and that particular issue that you highlighted in your newsletter? Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that what I kind of always want to point out is that sports have always been queer and sports are queer. And the erasure of that has kind of always been a thing that we're fighting against. But if people actually know to look for it, there's queerness in really every sport. I mean, come on, men's locker rooms are pretty gay. But that's a discussion for another day.
Yes, they are. And I just I want to point out so people can go to the Googles the work you did about the All-American, the Women's Baseball League during World War II and beyond, and the I guess you would call it the de-queering of that history, and your ability to reintegrate those lives into that storied history, I thought was just brilliant work.
Thank you. And, if for anyone listening was a fan of the very short-lived TV series A League of Their Own, where there were openly queer players, my research and reporting was used as research for that show because, yeah, I went through obituaries and looked for keywords and was able to actually put names to players, even though, we knew that there was obviously openly queer players. We didn't really know who they were. And so I was able to use their obituaries and kind of tell some of those stories. And I'm really glad that even though the show should have been gotten more seasons, that it was, recognized in that way.
That's totally true. So another moment that you highlighted so clearly was the Swiss commentator during Team Israel's bobsled run. This is a issue I know very important to me and my listeners. Could you speak a little bit about what that Swiss commentator brought to the table and the attendant backlash that took place?
And I think the important, overarching point before we even get there is that the IOC is incredibly hypocritical. We're at these international sporting games, and as much as the IOC wants to say that the Olympics are not political, they just are by their nature. As much as they want to say that there's no political imagery allowed, people are competing draped in flags, which what is a flag if not political imagery? And so the fact that Israel is allowed to compete in the Olympics, but Russia was sanctioned for invading Ukraine is again hypocritical. And we can see that's a political decision to allow Israel to compete in the Olympics. And so during the bobsled race, Team Israel, as they were racing, there was a Swiss commentator whose comments went viral. And instead of calling the run as a traditional bobsled run, he did not comment at all on anything that was happening during the run. And instead, he introduced listeners to the Israeli, athletes who were in the bobsled and quoted them as being, as self-identifying as super Zionist, and actually stated comments that the athletes had made supportively, about the genocide that is happening in Gaza and Palestine. And, he highlighted the fact that Israel was being allowed to compete. And that commentary had to be removed from, the internet, the broadcast company's website, because it sparked massive backlash. But he really was just stating facts. He was literally reading things that the athlete had said himself.
God, that sounds so familiar to things in this country. Like, how dare you say what people actually think? Like after the death of Charlie Kirk, like people losing their jobs for quoting him is
Yeah,
something.
did you see, by the way, I haven't read all the details yet because it just happened today, but apparently that same the Israeli bobsled athlete faked an injury, which is why he pulled out of the competition and provided a doctor's note. And apparently they've discovered that it was fake and he's in trouble. They've been disqualified after the fact.
Jeez. Well, other than to my 17-year-old son, that is not heroic activity. I'll just say, if I can say
No.
that. So not the Israeli part, the forging the doctor's note part, to be very
I mean,
clear.
kind of all of it. But I think,
Yeah.
especially if we want to look just at these games, though, we can see we have Russia being sanctioned and their athletes competing under a neutral flag. And, the sanctions are, for doping, but also invading Ukraine. And then you have Ukrainian athletes being disqualified for having imagery on their helmets that was related to the very thing that Russia was sanctioned for.
Wow. Yeah, exactly. And then you also think about the Haitian team being told that they couldn't wear a Toussaint Louverture's image because it
Yes.
was too political to have
Right.
the founder of their country on it. It's all so disgusting and so obviously tilted towards oppressive the most oppressive Western values and prior and political priorities.
Yes.
But I digress. So I definitely don't want you to go without saying something about the athletes who were, like, to me, like some of the real Olympic heroes, the ones who defended their right to speak out against Donald Trump, who defended their right to have free speech as Olympians. These folks really impressed me. It didn't feel like that, these are also not exactly sports where they can make a lot of money. They're deeply dependent on sponsorships and stipend wages. What was your general impression of that political part of these Olympics?
Jamil Hill has a great piece that just published today at the Atlantic about what she calls the impossible situation that US athletes were put in. And I really agree with this because, as you said, these are athletes who are, especially in the US, where we're one of the only countries that do not federally fund our elite athletes and don't pay our Olympians. And they're often having to raise money through sponsorships and GoFundMes just to get to the Olympic Games. These are people who have spent their whole lives training for sports that most people never watch. And if they do, they watch once every 4 years and forget their names the next week. They are not people who are used to being in the spotlight or as political spokespeople. And I think this is also where we get to the fact that the Olympics are political, whether the IOC wants to admit it or not, because now you have these athletes who just want to go compete in their very niche sport that, no one's ever heard of. Did you know you can cross-country ski while shooting a rifle, right? Like these are
Yeah.
biathlon,
Love
people.
it.
So you've got these athletes who are competing in these very niche sports. This is their kind of big opportunity on the Olympic stage, and they're having to answer for an administration that they may or may not support. They're being put in a position that they did not ask to be put in, and they have to make a decision: do I decline to say anything and look like I support, the horrific crimes that are happening, being committed by our state, or do I say something and then subject myself to the death threats and harassment that come with it? It's kind of a, it's a no-win situation really for them. And still, we have athletes who, took the opportunity to speak out, and they should be commended for that.
No, that's absolutely right. I totally agree. Well, you've been so generous with your time on this stuff. Is there anything else you'd like to add about these Olympics, about what they meant to you, about what you saw, what my listeners should know?
Yeah, I think the one kind of narrative that is emerging from these games that I think people should think really critically about is around gender. These are being called like the gender equality games because for the first time, women were able to compete in essentially every event except the Nordic combined. However, they're, still doing shorter distances and things like that because of sexism. But, there were more women at these Olympics than really any other. And we can also see that the US women dominate the medal count compared to the men. Women's sports received more primetime airtime than men's. They're more popular than men's, and yet they're still disproportionately covered overall. They're getting less investment. Women are winning more medals with less investment, especially in the US. And a lot of the coverage remains, sexist. The women's hockey final was considered, apparently, press who were there said it was not considered a high demand event, but the men's were. And so, even the ways we're talking about these women athletes who are, really dominating medal counts and the sports themselves are just kind of dripping with sexism. And so I think we need to think really critically about that. When we talk about gender equality, what are we actually talking about and how true is it?
Yeah, and I think you highlighted a tweet where, if we can still call him that, where it was pointed out that when the women won the hockey gold, it was, oh, look at this. This will inspire young girls to play hockey. And when the men win the hockey gold, it's, oh, look at this. They just inspired a nation.
Right. And I think it's so sexist. We have this around women's sports continually, that women are the women who are in the WNBA and the PWHL and the NWSL, are they are role models for the next generation of girls who are coming up. And it's like, oh, women have to nurture the next generation no matter what they're doing. Like, what, why can't they have be doing this for themselves, the thing they've trained their whole lives for? Why do they have to only be doing it if it is to inspire the next generation? It's like very, like, it kind of fits into the idea of women's role being to like nurture children and to like reproduce. And it like permeates how we talk about them in sport as well.
No, that's absolutely right. That's a great point. Well, Frankie, you've been so generous with your time. I'll say that again. How can people sign up for your newsletter and get more involved with your work?
I am on Instagram and Blue Sky at the Frankie DLC, and my newsletter, Out of Your League, is also at thefrankiedlc.news, and that is where I am.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining us here on the Edge of Sports podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you to Bijan Bain for his work on the history of Jesse Jackson and his intersection with the world of sports. Thank you so much to Frankie Della Creta, always indispensable with their knowledge. For everybody out there listening, I'm thanking The Nation Magazine for sponsoring this podcast. Please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.